democracy is about protesting. That's how you expand democratic rights. That's how you get women's rights. That's how you got the labor movement. That's how you got unions. That's how you got the civil rights movement. You had protests.
Four of Inside Without Now, a podcast hosted by volunteers with RefuseFascism.org. I'm Sam, one of those volunteers. Today, we're sharing conversation between Coco Das, one of the editors of RefuseFascism.org, and Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley, which was recorded on June 3rd, 2 days after Trump and his henchmen blasted peaceful protesters with tear gas and rubber bullets to clear a path for him to walk from the White House to St. John's Church across the street. This staged photo op featuring him, the attorney generals, and his military leaders provoked some major figures, including military figures like Jim Mattis and Colin Powell, to publicly denounce Trump, as discussed with Dr. Stanley during this interview. If you're having trouble making sense out of Trump's rhetoric and why it has such a captivating hold on his white supremacist fascist base, you'll want to check out Dr. Stanley's book, How Fascism Works. You'll also definitely want to follow Jason Stanley on Twitter, at JASONINTRATOR, and Coco Das at COCO_DAS. Today, June 14th, is also Trump's 74th birthday. As this episode airs, I'm en route to Washington, D.C., to participate in protests demanding his ouster, the only fitting way to quote-unquote celebrate the day. Our power is in the streets, and as people continue to express that power across the country with determined protests demanding an end to white supremacy, the danger that this regime poses has not subsided. Time and time again, this regime has shown that their answer to any challenge is to double down on their program, whip up their rabid and bloodthirsty base, and strong-arm their way to consolidate their force and their power. Are we in a new situation now, comparable only to something like 1968 in the history of this country? Yes. Does that mean we're at a tipping point for inevitable change, whether through the ballot box or other reforms? Hell no. It's critical we stay in the streets and raise the demand. Trump Pence, out now. After you listen to this discussion today, find out how you can get involved by visiting RefuseFascism.org and following us on social media at RefuseFascism.
To give a more formal introduction, Jason Stanley is the Jacob Urofsky Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. He is the author of several books, including How Fascism Works. He writes about authoritarianism, propaganda, free speech, mass incarceration, and other topics for several major publications. So let's jump in. You were one of the first public intellectuals to really draw this line between Trump and fascist politics. How Fascism Works, I think, got a lot of people to see that there were very dangerous underpinnings to what too many were dismissing as Trump's bumbling incompetence. I'm going to be talking to Jason mainly about Trump, but I just want to preface, for the moment, the focus is on Trump as the head of this fascist regime and a fascist movement that's been in the making for a long time. There is a whole regime behind him that I don't think gets enough attention. And this is a fascist movement that was already building up, mainly this Christian fascist movement that Pence is sort of the leading edge of. And I don't think that Trump could have won this election or gotten as far as he could without Pence. People like Catherine Stewart speak to this very powerfully. I want to jump in with you, starting with Trump's speech in the Rose Garden on Monday, that took place after or even while a peaceful protest was being violently cleared out. What did you see on display there, and what was your reaction?
Well, it's both heartening and very disturbing that Mattis took today to address what happened on Monday in Lafayette Park. What's heartening about it is that senior members of the military were disturbed by a fundamental breach in democratic institutions and checks and balances and distinctions between our state institutions. What's heartening is that this means that there's going to be some protection of our democracy from leading military officials. It's very important because any authoritarian wants to control the military and law enforcement. So what's disturbing is that the breach of etiquette, the situation that led to Mattis breaking his silence, must have been very large indeed. And it was very large indeed, because to tear gas peaceful protesters in the United States of America, while at the same time lauding Hong Kong protesters, who should be lauded, they're heroic, they also engage in property damage at some point. The hypocrisy is there, but to tear gas peaceful protesters in Washington, D.C., the sign that sends to the world, and then to use the military as a backdrop to subdue peaceful protests, which are at the heart of democracy. When I talk to my children, I say democracy is about protesting. That's how you expand democratic rights. That's how you get women's rights. That's how you got the labor movement. That's how you got unions. That's how you got the civil rights movement. You had protests. Democracy is about protests. It's about the people, free assembly. To have the military be involved in subduing pre-peaceful protests to give a photo op for the leader is a terrible authoritarian sign. It's both heartening because we know now that there are members of the military that are going to say, enough is enough. We are the military of a democratic society. And it's disturbing because clearly many of them went for this incredibly anti-democratic celebration of authoritarianism.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a really horrifying speech. This regime that has terrorized immigrants for 3 years, that has shredded the rule of law, then dares to call people who are standing up on the side of justice organizers of terror and domestic terrorists. But I also think it's heartening that the next day, more people came out. And this is a dynamic we've seen happen all over the world. The danger of it is it's still looming. In your book, you talk about 10 pillars of fascist politics. I don't know that we have time to go through all of them, but at this moment, are there one or two or three that you think are most salient?
Chapter 7 is called Law and Order. It's about what fascist law and order means. And I begin with Donald Trump, although I think, as you began, we should not focus excessively on Donald Trump because the obstacles to our democracy do not end with Donald Trump. They are deep, as the protests show. And I want to return to the importance of the protests. Chapter 7 is law and order, and it's about what law and order means in fascist politics, in fascist ideology, in fascist movements. Let me first be clear. We are a country that is on the precipice, but we still have a democratic regime. I mean, there's the Electoral College, there's the Senate, there's all sorts of obstacles to democracy. There's the depredations of financial capital. We have a democratic regime. We still have elections. They're being challenged and not clear how fair they are. But that doesn't mean we can't talk about fascism. Toni Morrison in 1995, in her Howard University commencement address, Racism and Fascism, talked about fascist forces and fascist answers to questions, to national problems. And she says the United States has far too often sought fascist answers to national problems. What we have now is a fascist movement. Hannah Arendt distinguishes totalitarian movements from totalitarianism in power. Totalitarian movements are what you have when you have, say, a fascist movement that is participating in the democratic process, that is seeking electoral power. And once it gains electoral power, it seeks to transform the democracy from within and transform it into a fascist regime. We are not at that moment yet of a fascist regime, and we might be quite distant from it, but we are far closer than we have been in quite some time. And we've been under Dick Cheney's vice presidency, and with George Bush, we had moments that were very frightening, but it wasn't a fascist movement like this, although it definitely had fascist elements. This is, I think, a fascist movement inside a democratic society that is seeking to transform the institutions into loyalist it's Gleichstellung, transform the institutions from separate institutions that are checks and balances on the leader's power into loyalist organizations. And deeply worrisomely, we've seen this with the Department of Justice. So what does fascist law and order mean? Fascist law and order does not mean let the institutions do their job and let the Justice Department pursue justice. Fascist law and order means, let me just be clear about the structure of fascism. Fascism is an ethno-nationalist movement. A fascist movement is an ethno-nationalist movement where the leader takes himself to be representative of the nation, where the nation is defined in terms of a favored race or a favored group, political. And this movement demonizes its opponents as enemies of civilization and communists. It describes anyone who is not part of the movement as a communist or a socialist and represents them as fundamental threats, political opponents. Demonizes the media, the free press, and freedom of assembly. And we are seeing all of those things right now placed at risk. Chapter 7, Law and Order, begins with Donald Trump and the Central Park Five. Donald Trump took out a full-page ad in the New York Times in 1989 calling for the execution of the Central Park Five. Central Park Five were five teenagers, completely innocent, who were accused of the horrific crime of raping a white woman jogger in Central Park. They were completely innocent. They were eventually exonerated, DNA evidence. They found the person who did it. And Trump said they should not have been exonerated and said the New York City should not have paid them for the horrors that they endured. Jeff Sessions, the attorney general who came in, said you can tell that he's going to be a law and order president from his reaction to the Central Park Five. So what does that tell us? The Central Park Five were five completely innocent young black men in New York City. What is fascist law and order that shows that Donald Trump was saying they were guilty? So what does guilty mean in this ideology? Guilty in this ideology means that you're a member of a targeted minority. Guilty means you're just someone that the leader has decided is guilty. That's what fascist law and order means. It means that the targeted minority, members of the targeted minority, as Toni Morrison said, young black men of the group are the targets, are in and of themselves criminal. So that's what fascist law and order means. He's declared essentially his political opponents to be a terrorist organization. Fascist law and order means that being a supporter of the leader and a member of the ethno-nationalist group means that you're law-abiding. And not being a supporter, not being a member of that group, means that you're a criminal. What we have is that conception of law and order. As Barr said in an interview after he dropped charges against Michael Flynn, when the reporter said to him, "What do you say? History won't look kindly on this," Barr said, "That depends who wins." In fascism, it's all about us versus them. There's no legitimate political opponent. Political opponents are always criminals. That's the situation we're facing. Now, on the positive side, we have street protests. We have nonviolent, peaceful street protests against racism. And why is it so important that they're against racism? As long as we have racial injustice in this country, as long as we have this chasm, two systems of justice, one for whites and one for blacks, one for poor and one for rich. And as long as we have that, because racial injustice is what allows the wealthy and the large corporations to separate poor whites and poor blacks, to separate us from each other, us from our fellow citizens on the basis of race. And this is the story of the United States. It's how you smash the labor movement. You use race to smash the labor movement. Everybody wants a weekend. Weekends are great. Everybody wants overtime pay. Everybody wants to be compensated for the work they do. Everyone wants a decent chance at the future and their children to have a decent chance at the future. What the story of the United States is you separate Americans from each other using race. And so as long as we have enormous racial injustice, we will always have fascist demagoguery. And that's why it's so crucial that these protests are about racial injustice. And it's so crucial that they're about our two systems of justice, because we have to have a cross-racial coalition to tackle economic injustice. As long as we have that yawning chasm, we won't have a labor movement. We won't have any of the challenges to the corporate class that we need to fully realize our democracy.
And I think you can really see the power of thousands or even hundreds in the beginning stepping out and saying, no more. This murder of George Floyd is intolerable. We're not going to take it. And then they, you know, waves of other people came in to join them. In my lifetime, a pretty unprecedented moment. I mean, I do want to go back to talking more about the protests, but I wanted to ask you one more question. I want to talk a little bit about the chaos that has surrounded Trump, and the regime have been able to seize on it to further and further degrade rule of law, to further and further advance their program. And you said in an interview recently, he's always going to go as far as he can go. Always. So I was wondering, talk a little bit about what that means concretely.
Great question, yeah. Coco. Jair Bolsonaro, I just published a piece with the historian of fascism, Federico Finkelstein, in the New York Times called The Paradox of Trump and Bolsonaro. And it's about how both of them are supposedly law and order presidents, but they encourage their supporters to take up arms against the government they themselves lead. The goal of any authoritarian is to get rid of the checks and balances. You want to get rid of the checks and balances, you can take over more and more of the government. You use your supporters to create chaos to threaten the institutions that may stand in your way of taking total power. Now, Bolsonaro, who is a student of Trump, he's the Trump of the tropics, it nevertheless goes further than Trump. So it's useful to look at Bolsonaro to understand what the strategy is, because Bolsonaro hides it much less than Trump. Bolsonaro openly calls for the military to come depose the courts and Congress. And the military says, nah, no thanks. What Trump wants is he wants as many branches of law enforcement and the military as possible behind him in the Justice Department. And he wants those to remove all the checks and balances. And so everything hangs upon people in those institutions, because obviously many of the Republican members of the Republican Party are not going to do it, standing up to that. He's going to go as far as he can. All the history tells us authoritarians always tell you what they're going to do. Trump is admirably clear about what he wants. He wants to rule forever. He says it repeatedly. His friends, who are his friends? He calls Putin all the time. He calls Kim Jong-un. These are the people he admires, not Angela Merkel, not Democratic leaders. He said, Bolsonaro's a great leader, he's doing a great job in Brazil. He thinks Bolsonaro's doing a great job in Brazil. Bolsonaro calls for, openly praises the military dictatorship and calls for the overthrow of his own government. What baffles me is that Trump is telling you what his goal is, and this goal will be held in by others. He's going to go as far as he can go. The Republican Party ultimately will need to stop him. But unfortunately, the Republican Party is laced through with anti-democratic forces. Hannah Arendt talks about the danger of placing loyalty to party over party. What she means by that is the danger of placing loyalty to your political party over a multi-party democracy. What we have now is too many members of the Republican Party. They're open about it. They're like, we're going to stack the courts. Trump and the Republican Party openly speak about partisan judges. They want to rule everything. And what we need is we need a democracy. We need social conservatives. We need socialists. We need conservatives. We need the whole group. And what we don't need is people who want to seize power for one group. And what happens when you're in fascism wins is people who aren't fascists, say traditional Christian conservatives, the business elite, they say, well, this is a tough guy who's going to get it done for us. They're going to pass, they're going to get us our big tax cut, they're going to destroy the labor movement, smash the union, they're going to smash the public schools, replace them with parochial schools, smash public universities, they're going to push through anti-abortion laws, anti-choice laws, they're going to attack same-sex marriage. In a democracy, you're going to have people in your democracy who have different views about issues of fundamental value, and that is fine. But what happens when fascism wins is that the leader of a fascist movement says to different groups in the right wing, the business elite, the social conservatives, I will get your agenda done as long as you play along with me. And that's what we have now, and that is deeply worrisome. And part of that, of course, is white supremacy. None of this would be happening if we didn't have white supremacy as a motivating goal to get people to not care about health insurance, to not care about the weekend jobs, their union, and just see someone humiliate black NFL players on national television. That's why these protests against racial injustice, which do channel the same, you know, where people are taking knees like Colin Kaepernick, that's why that is such a powerful symbol of the heart of this resistance to Trump.
In the second half, I'd like to talk more about the political crisis that's created by these mass protests, sustained mass protests, which has been part of our strategy for not letting fascism win since we began 3 years ago. I do want to pass it back to Sam and let her tell us what the audience is saying, and then we'll talk again.
Thanks, Coco. We have been getting awesome, thoughtful questions and comments like crazy. Thanks for everybody for being really engaged and thinking deeply about what Jason's bringing forward and the questions that Coco's putting out as well. So let me get into the questions. I wanted to share two in particular that I thought represented a lot. One was, what similarities do you see between Nixon's resignation, White House feeling under siege, to use Kissinger's words, and differences? How would you compare now to 60s law and order? The other question that came in from Twitter was, why is the religious right supporting fascism or totalitarianism?
I recommend to as many people as possible to read this book by Elizabeth Hinton, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. And she just published an article in the New York Times that I strongly recommend. It's about what was lost when Nixon came to office. One of the things is about where the protests in the 1960s in Watts, in Harlem, in Detroit, those protests were leading to substantial change. Nixon then changed the subject, focused on the property damage that was happening during the protests, the burning, and he changed the subject. That's why it's important to avoid the property damage, because you don't want to allow the changing of the subject. We need to be on the streets, but we can't have the message hijacked that way. So Nixon changed the focus to law and order by looking at black protest against police brutality and protest against the Vietnam War by college students. And that was the, as Elizabeth Hinton shows, that was the foundation of the war on drugs. As Nixon famously said, we're going to go after marijuana to get the hippies, meaning the war protesters, and we're going to go after heroin to get the blacks. Trump is using Nixon's playbook. Obviously, he used it in 2016. He's using it again now. It's very similar. You can have a reactionary response to this, and you can have what I would call the right response. The reactionary response would be to say, well, don't have mass protests, because Nixon was then able to change the subject. No, that is not the right response. We now see that many Americans across political divides see that there are two systems of justice. We have many Republicans seeing this, and they are reacting with horror at this administration's reaction. So it is actually a unique defining moment. Enough people across political divides, there's always going to be people who disagree on fundamental values in a democracy. My cousins are traditional Orthodox Jewish, and they disagree with me on lots of things, but they're part of my society. So there's disagreements. And right now, we have more and more agreement about fundamental racial injustice. And that is a big difference between now and 1968. It is a big difference. It is much harder for someone to change the subject. Black intellectuals have been bringing to our attention, and poets and novelists and singers and artists have been bringing to our attention for as long as this republic has been around, that there are two systems of justice. This will always be something that is used to divide us until we can deal with it. So I think that's a huge difference between now and 1968. Social media has allowed more and more people to see what has been always manifest to Black Americans, as you see from literature, art, and all the cultural creation. That's hopeful. That's enormously hopeful. It's not 1968. We have to pay attention to changing the subject. That's what Nixon did. He changed the subject. Vesla Weaver, the great scholar of mass incarceration at Johns Hopkins, Vesla Weaver has this paper, classic 2007 paper called Front Laugh. And in Front Laugh, she argues that what Nixon does is he changes the subject from racial injustice to law and order. That's what happens. Then when you change the subject to law and order, Barr ordered the clearing of Lafayette Park because of graffiti, you know, terrifying graffiti. So you can't let the subject be changed. That's the moral of Bessel Weaver's work. You can't let the subject be changed. You have to keep on racial injustice. And the difference between now and 1968 is many people, Republicans and Democrats, are not going to let the subject be changed from racial injustice to graffiti. Now, of course, there's been a lot of property damage that should be avoided at all costs, because it allows people, not only does it harm individuals who are members of our fellow citizens, but it allows people to change the subject. But we need to be on the streets, peaceful protest. That's the heart of the democracy. That's the heart of our democracy. So there's a big difference between now and 1968. Now let's go to the religious right, and then Coco, I think, has thought a lot about this. So the religious right, Bradley Hart has a great book called Hitler's American Friends, where he looks at the different groups, political groups in the United States, who were allies of National Socialism and against the United States joining the war against fascism. One of the chapters is called The Religious Right. Another chapter is called Big Business. Another chapter is called America First. This is American history. If you want to understand what's going on, in a broad sense, I would encourage you to Google Goebbels' 1935 speech, Communism with Its Mask Off. In that speech, Goebbels says, Judeo-Bolsheviks, the communists are coming. The communists are going to destroy your traditions. They're going to take your house. They're going to take your property and destroy your traditions. And the only people who will protect you are the Nazis. And he says, the Nazis allied are going to protect the German traditions, the religious traditions, against the depredations of communism. Now what we have is we have that broadening essentially fascist ideology saying instead of just Marxism, it's cultural Marxism. They're not just coming for your house. They're not just going to raise your taxes. They're going to destroy your culture. And really, that's what Goebbels is saying, too, in Communism with its mask off. So with a mask off, you can compare Goebbels' speech to Barr's Notre Dame speech and Trump's value voters speech. Both of them are like, we have harsh tactics, but we are going to protect your traditional values. So that's the thing. That's, remember what I said, people who aren't Nazis and the religious right are not Nazis. They're not fascists. They can be cowed into submission by the fear that their culture is going to be destroyed. What fascist politics does is it says to big business, the labor unions are going to take your profits. It says to the billionaires and the oligarchs, oh no, you know, the Green New Deal, the renewable energy, that's going to take your profits. It says to the religious right, the liberals in the cities, the gays, the feminists, they're going to turn your boys into girls. They're going to destroy your traditional culture. It says to the white supremacists. It says to the white nationalists. It says to people who are used to being at the center of the culture. It says to them, they're going to remove you from the center of the culture and place minorities there instead. And as Du Bois told us in Black Reconstruction, there's a psychological wage to whiteness. You're the center, you're the show. So it feels like something's being taken away from you that's like money when you're decentered to make room for equality. There's a few other fundamental, essentially philosophical points here about the affinity, the tension between democracy and the religious right, which is something that in a healthy democracy needs to be dealt with, because my cousins are traditional Orthodox Jews and should have every right to practice their faith as Christians of every variety should have, and Muslims and Hindus. You have to solve that. But ultimately, say Christianity involves authority, a sense that there is a structured authority. It's not democratic. It's not like everybody has the same say. There's God, there's a minister, they're over you in a hierarchy. That's an anti-democratic institution by its nature. And the idea of being in awe before God, in fascist politics, you represent the leader as godlike and linked to God, and the representative of God, the sword of God, the weapon of God. Finally, you have the issue that Coco began with, which is we have a unification of billionaire right-wing Christians in this country. They're behind Mike Pence, the Prince family, Eric Prince, the DeVos family, Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education. These are billionaires who fund libertarian, far-right, Christian conservative institutions and seek to replace our secular society with essentially religious institutions, charter schools, and destroy our public goods and have everything just be the private sector and religion. That's local to America. And Coco, I'm sure you know a lot about that, so go.
And when you think about what that means for women, for LGBT people, this is being advanced through the Supreme Court. There is a goal, I think, to institute a theocratic form of government. One of the things we say is that fascism is not just a pendulum swing. It's a remaking of society and government. It's a different form of rule. And if it consolidates, then it is much harder to stop it. Paxton talks about these stages. And in this last stage is when you get to genocide. There is a genocidal, you said it's an ethno-nationalist movement. There's a genocidal element. Everybody else is criminal, right? I do want to talk, dwell a little bit more on this. Everybody's talking about 1968 in this moment and what it means to create a political crisis where hundreds of thousands of people right now are showing that the rulers are not all powerful and that are being fearless. And I use the word in my writing, ungovernable. What that creates, what that breaks open in society. One thing about Nixon is that he didn't make it through his second term. And I always wonder if it had not been on the heels of this upheaval in society, would Nixon have gotten farther in degrading the rule of law and staying in the Vietnam War, all the things that they had intended to do that didn't end up being allowed to do. In our mission, it has been to start this process of sustained nonviolent mass protest that makes this demand that this fascist regime that on the way to fascism, it's not consolidated. They need to be driven out before they can consolidate. When there's a movement from below, that then creates a situation where the people at the top are scrambling to find a resolution. And that resolution often means that this person has to go. I think we both agree that this moment is extremely important and transformative. I wanted to ask you, did you expect something like this to happen?
That's not in my scholarly range, so I don't speak to that. As far as your point about the importance of an ungovernable people, the fascist leader must be infallible. He must be invulnerable. We're seeing Donald Trump's support weaken because he is not in control of the streets. Jonathan Metzl, the author of Dying of Whiteness, We had a discussion together, and he told me that many of the people he spoke to who supported Trump said they would support someone who was tougher than Trump. The fascist leader has to be invulnerable. This is why you can see they have to project total power and might. To prevent fascism, to retain democracy, the institutions have to have no one person who has that power, otherwise it's not a democracy. And the people have to step in when someone seeks that power. The way the relationship goes between the supporters and the leader is if the supporters see that the leader doesn't have that infallibility, their support will start to weaken. We need to keep these protests up for multiple reasons. Number one, because they weaken the bond between Trump and his supporters. His supporters see that he's not infallible and all powerful. They retain our democratic spirit. And number two, these protests speak to what makes us vulnerable to fascism, which is our racial divide.
I think there's a moral dimension to it. One of our Ed board members, Sarah Work, speaks to really beautifully. She wrote a piece called Drinks at Sobibor. She makes this point, what you allow is not only what you condone, it's what you become. We were seeing this situation where over 3 years, if people in 2016 were told that they were going to accept tens of thousands of immigrants in concentration camps, that they were going to accept the constant lying, 100,000 people dead from a pandemic because of this anti-science regime. I think they would say, no, I'm not going to accept that. But there was this process of normalization over the last 3 years, which has been broken now. People have lost their adjustment.
This is something Trump does. Mm-hmm. He barrels forward with a really harsh thing, like the Muslim ban, and then it gets rejected. And then he gets a slightly less harsh version through while everyone is patting themselves on the back. And he's done this repeatedly. He has to be taken very seriously. The Muslim ban, that got passed. Everyone was congratulating themselves that didn't get passed. Well, it did get passed, just a softer version. So that's what he's doing. He's testing every boundary. The first thing doesn't work. Everyone congratulates themselves, and then he gets like a slightly weaker version through. He does it again and again. Second point I want to make, and this underscores this terrific book by Elizabeth Cohen called Illegal, which is about the immigration, the attack on human rights, system of horror facing undocumented human beings. What that system is it's completely interlocked with the system of justice that faces Black Americans. It is one and the same mass system of prison camps. What we have in the United States, it's a cliche, but you cannot repeat it enough. 25%, almost 25% of the world's prisoners. We rail about human rights, but the targeted minority in our country, African Americans, along with indigenous people and Latinos, that system is one system. So we have 10% of the world's prison population comes from the 38 million African Americans. That is shocking. There are a few times in human history where one tiny little group, 38 million, that's 13%, 12 to 13% of the United States, is 10% of the world's prison population. This system directed against undocumented immigrants, this system of incarceration, that's the system that is used for targeted minorities and maybe soon for opponents of this regime. So they're interlinked. We need to disassemble these prison camps and disassemble carceral solutions to political problems.
The point that we have been making is that this regime is a blocking issue to any advancement of any of our social justice issues, climate crisis, the white supremacy, police killings. If we drive them out, then we can begin to advance our struggles. But as the call said that Sam read, should we fail and then they go on to consolidate power, then every struggle for social justice will be set back. I just want to ask one more question. In your studies of fascist politics, what can we expect from those in power in response to an uprising like this? And have you ever seen an example of a fascist leader going peacefully?
There are dictators that die in office. I mean, Trump will do everything he can to stay in office. He tells you that. Why not believe him? As his supporters will tell you, finally, we have someone who tells it like it is. These protests are also important for that. They're also important because they set people on warning that the people are not going to stand for that. That's not to take away with it from their fundamental message, which is that there are two systems of justice, that Black Americans have been treated with disrespect many dimensions as long as there's been a United States. And as long as we have that, we're not going to be united as a country.
Well, that concludes my questions for you. I do want to urge everyone again to go get the paperback of Jason's book, How Fascism Works, and follow Refuse Fascism on all our platforms at Refuse Fascism. So I'm going to pass it back to Sam. Let's see if we have any other questions or comments that came in.
Paul wrote, Jason, a left political scientist friend of mine, says all his colleagues screw up their faces and become condescending when he, who has written many books, uses the F word in relation to Trump and Trumpism. I'm curious to know what kind of experience you have in the academy and having the audacity, intelligence, to relate the current moment to horrors, fascism. What's up with the big shot academics on this?
Academia is all about seeking respectability. There are different reasons in different groups. Political scientists always want to argue that what they're doing is a science, which of course it's not. And their way of doing it is saying, oh, we're objective. We use objective terminology, and fascism is a term that is laden with subjectivity and condemnation. So we shouldn't use it. We should just describe people neutrally. I'm a philosopher of language. There's no such thing as a neutral description. Every word has a connotation. Every word has moral valence. Semantic warfare is a fact of life. There's no such thing as neutral terminology. Then there's also the historians. There's an old debate about whether fascism should be used broadly or should be used narrowly as just a political movement that occurred in Italy and Germany until 1945. People differ on this. I use it broadly. There's both right-wing theorists like Ann Snolta and left-wingers who use it more broadly. There's different traditions of its use. The European historians who feel like they own it say, no, fascism is our word. My work is based in a Black intellectual tradition that does use that word and has since Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. Not with frequency, but it does occasionally. And it uses it to describe an ideology that affected Hitler. The Nuremberg citizenship laws were based on our anti-miscegenation laws, as my colleague Jim Whitman's book, Hitler's American Model, shows. Hitler admired our racial hierarchy, our immigration laws that barred Asians and non-whites generally from American citizenship. So I have no hesitation about talking about fascism as a movement.
Thanks for listening to Inside Without Now. As Jason Stanley just talked about, a crucial part of undermining Trump's legitimacy is staying in the streets. Our refusal to knuckle under the threats of repression and violence is essential. We call on everyone to see that the fight for justice now must include a growing movement of people, the millions who do not want to live under white supremacist mob rule in a fascist America, preparing to fill the streets in sustained, nonviolent protest to drive the fascist Trump-Pence regime out of power. Should we fail to do so, this and every struggle for justice will be set back and eventually crushed. On the other side, should we do this? We will begin to lift the boot off the necks of our brothers and sisters. You can get involved at refusefascism.org. Support this movement by clicking the donate button there, Venmo, refuse-fascism, or Cash App, Refuse Fascism. Again, connect with us on social media by following at Refuse Fascism. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Trump Pence, out now. See you in the streets soon.